Well, it's been so long since I've been here, I must say hello, and good to see everybody. To those along the tape program, I'm sure you are anticipating when he's going to finish that series on child rearing. Well, today's the day, part two. We'll get into that in a few moments. I must comment on the beauty of this January. For those who are up in the northern climes digging through snow and slosh and all that sort of thing, this is kind of great. I've been working on my tan, and I think I've been doing a pretty good job at it, don't you think? I don't know of any beaches around, but you could just kind of walk outside in all of the sun. I do a lot of walking now, and if I do look slimmer, don't adjust your set. It's just that I am losing a few pounds on purpose. So I feel pretty good and glad to be back here and excited about continuing this series that I started a month or so ago on parenting. I had two situations occur yesterday that focused my mind a bit on this sermon and in preparing for it, and I'd like to relate them to you at this time. After I came back from the doctor's where I did my bi-weekly weigh-in, I decided to stop at Burger King. Well, anybody who knows anything about calories, that's not the place to stop. But I did because they're giving away free a ticket that will allow you to fly a companion free any place that Southwest Airlines flies. So I thought I'll have to go in here and buy this Whopper, you see. Whopper meal, I think you get. And you get this free ticket that will be good for a future flight. And I have to think in these terms I have a son here who goes with me everywhere. And so I thought I'll do that. I probably shouldn't have eaten all of the Whopper, though, because that's 650 calories, if you didn't know that, without the cheese. It's 750 with the cheese. That's right. So in case you want to remember that for future reference, the fries are 210 calories, the small order. So all of that stuff adds up. Now you keep pounding that down, it will show up eventually. But anyhow, while I was there, and as I tend to do when I'm in public, I notice children, and I notice their parents, and I notice those who are successful in dealing with their children, and I notice the ones who have that haggard look, you know, chasing the little darlings around. Well, this one particular woman, she had three children, and the youngest one, probably about 2.5, no more than 3, insisted that he did not want to sit where she had designated him to sit. In fact, he didn't want to stay inside in the cool environment. He wanted to go outside where all of the play things are, you know, out here on Broadway where the Burger King is. They've got all of these attractions for children. So this child of 2.5 insisted in his very vocal way, you know how children do when they're upset, "I don't want to sit there." You see, and of course the mother dutifully obeyed her child's wishes and went outside where all of her children proceeded not to eat the food she had just spent her money on because they're all just having a great time playing. Now there is a time to play and there is a time to eat. Who determines what course of action should be taken? A 2.5-year-old? A 10-year-old? Or the person who pays the bills, or the bigger person. In my case, I am still the bigger person with my children, and therefore I determine a lot of things about what they do. Now, in relationship to that situation, I talked with my mother last night, and you all know my mother from the first tape. I mentioned her copiously in relating some child-rearing things to you. I called and talked with her, and we were talking about different things, and she said, "Well, two of the children that I used to keep, I no longer have." Well, she had them a week ago when I was in Detroit. She still was keeping them. But because one of the little darlings, I guess he's about 3 years old, decided to tell his parents something relating to a child that my mother had previously kept all the way back in October. She no longer keeps this other child, but this young 3-year-old decided to tell his mother and father something about that situation that caused them to come down and take their little darlings home. They live on the same block. Because they were upset by something that this other child did, and the other child is very rambunctious, very vocal, very, well, he's from a single-parent home, and he says things and does things that, you know, a child of four or five, you just, well, shouldn't be doing. But he was a witness to all those types of things, and so he had to be worked with, and my mother did, and the lady eventually married, and her husband, the stepfather of this child, desired to work with this young young boy to help him progress. Well, the point about the story was that the parents believed this child. This child lied, but the parents believed it because their little darling couldn't possibly fabricate anything or tell an untruth, not at 3 years of age. But we know that children learn and do things, and they fabricate and they build and erect buildings all the time. Just think back to yourself as adults on how you schemed and connived and skirted around trying to get out of the eye of the situation, you see. Well, those two incidents kind of focused my mind a little bit more on this continuing saga of parenting. Parenting is the key to child rearing, and as I will kind of rehearse a bit from what we talked about the last time, we got into some discussion a little bit about the Word of God reveals how important children are to Elohim, to the Creator. Very important. And we looked at the life of Abraham and asked the question, well, why did he please God so much? Was it simply because he was obedient concerning leaving his relatives in the Chaldees and moving out as God had commanded him to do? Was that it only? And we discussed the fact that there were four things about parenting that Abraham showed in his life. He was a concerned parent. He was an active parent. He was an exemplary parent, and he was a God-fearing parent. And the result was he had a model child. Isaac was a very model child. He had some problems in child rearing himself a little bit later, which we will explore at a later time. But the fact is, Abraham was very special to God, and he displayed that specialness in how he dealt with his children. We also discussed the fact that even long before Solomon made the statement about train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old he won't depart from it, Moses recorded in the book of Deuteronomy the startling statements about how we as parents are required to teach our children, teach them what we believe, teach them why we live the way we live, teach them the things that we do, teach them why you think like you think. We had to accept the fact that God instructs us, the instructions are for us, but we also must not ignore our responsibilities to our offspring and our progeny, our heritage and our children. We also learned that training and teaching are actually two different things. They are connected, they are related, but they're not the same thing. First of all, you must teach a child. You teach them. That involves gaining a child's undivided attention, you see, undivided attention, and taking time to give instruction about how to do something, how not to do something. And after you have taught them, you then allow them in the training process of repeatedly and diligently practicing what you've taught. We discussed all of those things to lay a foundation for what is to follow. Well, I'm continuing the foundation laying today because I think in my projection this will be a total of four in the series when it's completed, and I think that a little bit more preparation needs to be made before we go on. There are many opinions in existence about parenting and child rearing. As the example I cited to you, the woman in Burger King decided that, oh, I can't upset this child out here in public because, after all, people will be looking at me. Well, they were looking anyhow because this child got its way. And I hung around long enough to observe, to see just how far this would go. Well, He was on the slides just having a great old time. The fries were getting cold and the food was getting cold. And, you know, if it's time to play, why buy the food? So there's a problem with the person in control, you see, determining what is best for this two-year-old. Because the two-year-old does not know, does not understand how much the Burger King costs, or the time that's being expended in waste, or whether it is right now to be playing. Doesn't understand any of that. But the parent should. After all, they're in control. Are they not? Well, because there are so many opinions, like the parents who decided, well, surely their child did not lie or, you know, misrepresent the truth, and therefore, let's just take them away from here. We only have to walk two houses down to drop them off on our way home, way off to work every morning, just two houses, you see. Now we got to carry them across town, you know, and now we got to pay more for a babysitter than they were paying. But there are many opinions about parenting. Some are sound opinions, and others are unwise. There are whole sections in bookstores, both secular and religious bookstores, dealing with the subject now of parenting. There was a time, way in the distant past, when there was not a lot of information in existence on parenting or child rearing, as it was known. Some of the common thread that runs through some of this material can very easily identify the problem, but the solutions differ. You have Dr. Spock, for instance, who was the authority on child rearing in the post-war, World War II period of time. And we have a saying of jokingly talking about Dr. Spock, and so we have Spock marks all over our children, you see, because of his influence in child care. He was a learned individual who put down in a book form a lot of very helpful things on child rearing and concerns about what parents need to know, because there is just no school you go to learn those things. Then there is James Dobson, who is out in California, and he has a program called Focus on the Family, where the whole thrust of his ministry, the whole thrust of his concern is toward the family, whether it's marriage, whether it's child rearing. And so he has an entire ministry geared in that direction. And then there's a man named Dr. G.T. Armstrong, who wrote a book a few years ago. This is the old worldwide copy of it. It was originally done in 1963 and revised in 1970. And he had some interesting observations about child rearing. On the cover page of this particular publication, he says, and remember, put it in the framework of the late 60s and 70s. Never has there been a time when the truth about child training has been more sorely needed. We are faced with a veritable landslide of juvenile crime and lawlessness. And certainly that was true, and it's probably even more true today. Beside those future millions who will actually become entangled with law enforcement agencies, there are many times that number who, even though not actually running afoul of the law, are rebellious, hostile, frustrated, and have no personal desire to make something of themselves. What can you do to ensure yourself against the eventuality of having your children become delinquent, and to have a guarantee that your children will grow up being obedient, respectful, considerate, and loving, having the right values and real sense of responsibility? And that is the bottom line. I tell you, the parent at Burger King wants that for that young son, wants the same thing. The parents down the street from my mother want their children to be productive, to be well-balanced and centered and so forth. But the problem is, how do you acquire that? How do you accomplish it? Now, I must insert at this point the statement that I made last time for those who don't have children, those who have gotten rid of their children through some means or another, you know, perhaps by marrying them off or sending them off to school, or those who, you know, are grandparents or extended family. It's important, brethren, not to tune out, to turn off and click off the hearing aids at this point, because, you see, as I said last time, parents need help. It is far more difficult today to rear children than it was in the past. Far more distractions, far more concerns out there, and parents need help. It may come from other relatives. It may come from extended family. It may come from the church environment. Because as I said last time, the progeny of our children, the heritage that are our children, must be cultivated if we exist as a church, if we continue to exist. You look around and you see either white hair or absence of hair, which means that some of us are not long for this world. But we have children, and we have grandchildren, and do we want them to be concerned about the things that concern us? Do we want them to share in the call that we have been given by God? And how do you do that? How do you accomplish that? We don't think of our children necessarily as being delinquent. You know, the police, you know, they're not at the door necessarily all the time, you know, telling us to come get Junior, you know, out of the hokey, the pokey, you know. That's not happening all the time, but occasionally it does happen with those related to the church. To avoid that, the question then is, what can you do? As parents, as extended church members or extended family members, or as a community of the church, what can you do? First, recognize God is the master architect. The architect of building a family. That's the first place to begin. What he says goes. And if what he says goes, he speaks through his word and lays the foundation for the building. Last time we looked at the life of a little bit of Cain, and we asked the questions of how did Cain get that way? How did he become the first murderer? How did he become the first liar? And why were his parents so absent when he eventually killed Abel? And it was God who had to directly deal with this delinquent. Where were they? What were they doing? What were their concerns? What mistakes did they make that led up to Cain killing his brother? The family difficulty and the squabble there. Well, when you study situations like that, you look at the life of Abraham and how he related to Isaac and the things that he did, including choosing Isaac's wife or making provisions to choose his wife. Now, in 1989, I mean to tell you, to even think about fabricating a marriage for somebody, I mean, young people today would just run out of the room screaming if that had to be the way it was. It is not that way today, but it certainly was in Abraham's time, and believe it or not, Isaac went along with it. Whew, boy, what a child. What a guy. To go along with what his daddy wanted. Did his daddy know best? Well, we could ask Robert Young about that. Did father know best? Well, in that instance, he certainly allowed his will to be done. Not only at that point in time, when you go back to realize that Isaac was not a young little child, you know, of two or three, when they went off to Mount Moriah to have himself offered as an offering. He was very aware of the situation. He asked the question, well, where's the sacrifice? We've got the wood. You've got the knife. We're on our way to Mount Moriah to make this offering. Where is the sacrifice, Daddy? And his father told him, the Lord will provide. And he went right along every step of the way, the three-day journey, picturing Christ in the 3 days he was dead. So Isaac was as good as dead, as far as Abraham was concerned. We see all of these biblical examples of parents making success or failure. But what can you do is the question. Well, recognize that God's word is important. Let's turn over to Proverbs, first chapter. And we're going to spend a little time in this book. Proverbs is a most interesting book. I'll tell you a little bit about it. I think I may have mentioned it last time or maybe in some other place about the book. Many assume that Solomon wrote every line in the book. Well, he didn't. Solomon was a collector of Proverbs. He collected a lot of sayings, and yes, he authored a number of them, but he didn't author all of them. But he was guided by God's Spirit to collect all of this sage advice, this compilation of wisdom. And the first nine chapters of the book have so many quotes dealing with children that if we spent any amount of time, a significant amount of time in it, we would gain great insight. You see, the book of Proverbs was not only written for children, it was also written for parents. It's written for all of us to learn and profit thereby. In the seventh verse of the first chapter, we read, "The fear," unfortunate King James translation, "the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." It's the starting place. It's the commencement, if you will. Fear should best be translated the reverence, the respect, the awe. That's the way it should read. The awe of God, or the fear of God, or the reverence of God, is the beginning of knowledge. That's where you start. You want to start dealing with your own spirituality? You want to start in dealing with your financial situation? You want to start with dealing with how to build character? Where do you want to start? What discussion do you want to enter into? The beginning of it is the reverence and respect of the eternal God. It goes on to say, "But fools despise wisdom and instruction." And the word instruction would best be translated discipline, which is a word that, I tell you, that causes a lot of difficulty for people. Well, you should discipline your child. Well, that immediately the connotation is you should whack his behind. That's the immediate connotation about discipline. But that's not all that there is to it. Discipline, you hear the word disciple in there, don't you? Which means student. So it means to train or to instruct or to teach. And the only method of teaching is just not taking out the paddle or whatever method you use for corporal punishment and whacking a child with that. That's not the only way. That's the quickest way. That's the easiest way. That's the way that most parents like to gravitate towards because, it's instant. And there's an instant response. To sit and to talk and to train, and the last resort being the punishment like that, takes a little bit more time. So the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. That's where we start. The reverence of God and His Word. It goes on in verse 8 and 9 to say, My son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. Now, that is read to in sermons given to children. That's read to the children. Children, understand that. Read that, and this is what you do. But if you're not careful, if you don't do a little research, you might miss the point that the category of my son was that of the student. And the application of the phrase my father was to the preceptor, or the person doing the teaching, as well as the mother. So in the Jewish idiom, this was an idea that there's a student and there's a teacher. And this was best exemplified in the family relationship. The mother and father to the child. So the instruction that was to be given was first instigated or instituted in the home, in the family. My son, hear the instruction of your father, and don't forsake the law of your mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace unto your head, a crown, as it were, and chains, not as you were chained and shackled. But, today we like to wear the 14 carat, or 20 carat, the 18 carat gold, chains. That's in style, to have a few chains around your neck. Not as many as Mr. T, but, enough around there that people know you've got some bucks, or the illusion of it. So you're going to have this ornamentation. People are going to recognize that you're doing okay. They're going to see by the fruit of your life that you are complying with the wishes of your parents. Now, in verses 10 through 19, which we won't read through, in those verses we see an example of how peer pressure should be avoided. Now, some of our children are at stages where peer pressure is irrelevant, really. They're at home for the most part. They haven't even gone into public schools. But when you allow them to become social, to interface with other young children, there will be peer pressure. I can remember back to my preschool days of having to be in the midst of other children, and they would say things like, I got a new bike. Did you get one? You know? So the pressure is on you now. Well, what can I come back with to beat that out? You know, what can I say to one-up them? You know, well, I got a new gun, or, you know, back in my Hopalong Cassidy days, I got something else new, or I went over to visit Chicago, or I did something. So the pressure is on you as a child in the sandbox to kind of one-up. And the peer pressure is there, so as you get older, it may be, have you tried this? This is Colombian gold. You know, have you tried this? Well, no, I haven't tried that because my parents said, you know, well, you ought to try this. It won't hurt. Take a toke on this. You know, snort a little of that. You know, have a drink of this. It just goes on and on as you get older. So the peer pressure is there. And in verses 10 through 19, we have a discussion of how you should avoid it. And it goes on to say, my son, if sinners, clearly defined, and if you have done your job as a parent, you can allow your child to know how to distinguish who is a sinner and who is not. Not that they call them sinners, but by their actions you know. By their fruit you know who people are. And the advice is here, when do you begin to instruct your children about selecting friends and fraternizing with the wrong crowd? When do you begin that? After they're in high school or junior high? Is that when you start? Or do you start prior to that? Is it perhaps in elementary school? The fact of the matter is, brethren, it starts with you. It starts long before the child is even here. It starts with you. But once they are here, and you know the old scenario, honey, I have something to tell you. I'm pregnant. What? What? Oh, my, what should we do? You know, that's generally the way it goes. The planning process, you know. That's great, and it's a blessing when somebody can say, you know, we planned this. We had it all calculated out. And the child came along, and it was just a blessing. Well, we really prayed and planned for this. But for the most part, it's always, honey, I have something to tell you. And so no preparation, not even diet, you know, for the wife to take care of herself. You know, she may have been smoking six packs, you know, for the week, you know, and belting down a couple of bottles of booze or whatever it is, and all of a sudden she's pregnant. Now, okay, what do I do? And some continue to do things deleterious to their health. And so when the children come out a little hyped up or a little out of sorts, well, how did this happen? Well, the health agencies tell you, you must make preparations prior to ever becoming pregnant. And then while you're carrying this child, ladies, for those 9 months, that gestation period, what's the frame of mind? How many arguments are going back and forth? You know, what's going on in the family? And here comes the child into this environment, you see, and what are they greeted with? Arguments about this and that, an unsettled environment. Is that going to be conducive to producing what you want in your child? I think not. But beyond those discussions, brethren, when do you start to teach? Well, obviously it begins with us as parents prior to the child coming. But once they're here, at all the various stages along the way, especially in the younger days of their lives, shouldn't you not teach them how to win friends and influence people, how to choose friends, how to make decisions? You know, when they run into the house and say, Mommy, Joey hit me. Or Joey said, or Mary said this or did that. How do you deal with that? Isn't that where you start? And your reaction, your response is crucial. Because it sets a pattern from that time on how they select friends, how they deal with unpleasurable situations, unhealthy situations. It starts there. I remember any number of occasions, and children have falling outs. You know, it's just the nature of the thing. Even in the family, they have these disagreements, and you have to referee. You have to be in control of the circumstances, and sometimes it has to be done when you least want to be involved, when you would rather be doing your nails or working on the car, changing the oil, or doing something else, but you've got to drop everything and begin to take care of the situation. Well, if it starts with us, and we must be actively teaching our children, recognizing God's word as the authority, your children are here. And you have made lots of mistakes in your life prior to having children or while they are here. All of that affects them, and it affects you. But what do you do when the horse is out of the barn? Now they're teenagers, you know. And all of a sudden your mind has been open to understand about the Sabbath and all the truths that we as a church incorporate into our beliefs. And we have children. In the principle about Christmas, for instance, I mean, if you've been keeping Christmas for 15 years and your children have been involved in that all that time, how do you do that? Cold turkey? Lop it off, you know, to a 15-year-old that's not being called? What do you do with that? How do you deal with that situation? There is no blanket policy about that. You have to deal with what it is and where you are at the time. So, once the children are here, the horse perhaps is out of the barn. The second thing to recognize, brethren, or to understand, is that the family is the basic building block of any society. Is the material that you are building with solid and sound? Is it? Is it for the building of a building that is going to stand? Or will it crumble and fall when the winds of adversity come upon it? Well, that question only we can answer. You know, sometimes we build on a fault line, you know, an earthquake fault, and the material looks great, it's sound and solid, and an earthquake comes along and the building crumbles anyhow. Even with all of the care and the attentiveness that you've given to it, it still crumbles. Well, as I said, the book of Proverbs is replete with information for consideration. In this book, as I said, it was written both for children and for parents. And we must get into a mode of thinking when we are concerned about child rearing to kind of roll the Proverbs around on the palate of our minds. It's kind of like you would, you know, sampling a little wine, you know, and you're going to test the vintage, and you're going to savor the aroma, the aperitif of it, and you're going to kind of hold it in your mouth there on your tongue before you swallow it. The Proverbs are like that. Roll it around on the palate of your mind. You then ingest it or swallow it, and let the fruit that Solomon collected be digested. Because Solomon understood. He knew. He had wisdom. Let's just take a look at some of the Proverbs and some of the things he said in collecting this information. Now, we read in the first chapter, chapter 3, verse 1, and I must remind you, because it constantly says, my son, it might as well have said, my child. It could have said, my daughter, so daughters don't feel excluded. I'll insert my child in so that we understand that that's the category is talking about children, not just the male gender. My children, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace, they will add to you. Now, how do you begin to do that sort of thing? And when should you start? Should you wait till the child can understand every syllable that you recite to them? Doesn't it begin early on, you know, when you're holding them in your arms and not talking baby talk? What's that? Are they going to talk baby talk when they're five? No, they're going to talk English, hopefully. And so you're going to spend time talking and sharing and expressing concern and love. And when they stumble and fall, are you going to be able and equipped to teach them that you do stumble and fall, even when you're an adult? Will you take opportunities to instruct them so carefully as the proverb is doing? Well, over in the fourth chapter, hear, O children, the instruction of a father, and give attention that you may gain understanding, for I give you sound teaching. Do not abandon my instruction. When I was a son to my father, says this proverbist, tender and the only child in the sight of my mother, then he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words, keep my commandments, and live. When the young child at Burger King insisted on going their way, you see, there's going to be a time when that child may be around the curb or walking out from Burger King to the parking lot, and mama says, stop, don't move. But if the child is conditioned to doing its own thing, tragedy can result, even at two. But the point is not about whether it's time to eat at Burger King. That's not even the point. The point is when life gets crucial, when it gets really critical, and this child needs to be instructed on how to make decisions. Do you wait until they come to you and say, Mama, I'm pregnant? Is that the time to make decisions about choices? Or the son comes in and says, Dad, I borrowed the car. I really appreciate that, but the police just dropped me off, you know, because I piled the car up. I mean, I picked up the guys and we went out, you know, kind of hanging out, and a couple of guys had a couple of beers, you know, open in the car. Is that the time to talk about instruction? About making right decisions? Wrong time. Wrong time. It goes back before that. I was telling my son the other night, and something at the house that I was not happy about, I was saying, it's not about that I'm talking about. I'm talking about decisions made long after this. And at your point in life, you need to understand that. Because I won't accept just, well, okay, he's only so old, and therefore, you know, I got to make allowances for them. Well, not really. Not really, because it's tougher now. When I was 15, maybe it was devil-may-care and carefree, you see. But it's a little more difficult now. The things that children are confronted with today makes it even more difficult. In the best of environments, in the best of circumstances, and therefore we must be more vigilant and more alert. And the Proverbs talk to that. Verse 10 of the fourth chapter. Hear, my child, and accept my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. I have directed you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in upright paths. When you walk, your steps will not be impeded, and if you run, you will not stumble. Conquer what's out there for you. A child who has been nurtured in the proper environment will bring great honor and peace to you. And you can sleep at night. My mother used to tell me, you know, while you're asleep, you know, and resting, I'm awake. I'm considering to be several steps ahead of you. You see. So, I mean, there's nothing you can sneak over on me. I can think back to times when I was lying to my mother like a rug. You know, I mean, just as straight faced as you could possibly, and think, well, I got through that because she didn't slap me upside the head or some such thing, you know. I know that I got away with that, but later on I found out I hadn't. She just didn't choose to act on it. Because parents know children. Oh, they know. They just may not always react and let you in on the fact that they know you're lying. But they know. Why? Because they were children too. They know what they did. And there's something about the vibes that are sent off, you see, that will help a parent know. And so the Proverbist here collects these sayings and instruction. Verse 20, my child, give attention to my words. Incline your ear to my sayings. Do not let them depart from your sight. Keep them in the midst of your heart. There were things that I wanted to do because of peer pressure when I was growing up. But my mother had said, uh-uh. You know, in the the inner city or among blacks, there was the tradition, not tradition so much, but the style to have your hair processed, you know. And now they have the Jerry curls and all that kind of thing. But they used to have, you know, Nat King Cole, I mentioned him as an individual who had his, and Sammy Davis, both had their hair processed, you see. And so a lot of black youths did that. My mother said, if you come in the house like that, you can't stay here. So I never came in the house like that. It was just that simple. And remember, I told you I was bigger than my mother a long time. A long time. But I just wouldn't do that. I told you last time how at 15, I left the block. At 15. You see. My friend said, let's go see the girls over, you know, on the next block. And I left the block, and she got a clothesline and explained to me in terms I could understand that I was not to leave the block. Okay? Now, some people have a problem with that, you know, with laying a little physical punishment on somebody, but I guess when you're 15 and you're about 6'1 and your mother is 5'5 and she wants to make the point, there she made the point. And I understood it. What was most troubling about that whole situation was not the clothesline. That really didn't hurt at all. The fact is, she was working so hard administering the punishment, and I realized this is really putting her through a whole lot that's unnecessary. I mean, she's really working hard, out of breath, you know, the whole thing, and I could have just short-circuited all of that by staying on the block. It would have been just that simple. And that's the way I was thinking while that was going on at 15. So that was the last one that I ever got. I mean, I had some verbal ones, but that was the last physical deprivation. I told somebody this recently, when I was out of high school and had purchased my own car, she told me one time to put the keys on her dresser. I put the keys on her dresser. Now, was I a chicken? No, I was all city football player. Lifted weights. I mean, you know, I was bad. But Mama said, and you see, these scriptures here are talking about that in chapter 5 and verse 1. My child, give attention to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding. Because children, parents have gone where you're trying to go. They really have. They may not always be correct. They may not always be right. But because they have said it, you need to consider it. You really must consider it and do it. It says very clearly, the promise is very sound that if you do, it will be well with you. In verse 6, well, the commandment that says, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land. There's a promise associated with that command. Chapter 6 and verse 1, my child, if you have become surety for your neighbor, having given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth. Now, this is when you've done something, when you've blown it, when you've done something wrong. Here's some instruction here. When you've been snared with the words of your mouth, you spoke too soon, you committed to do something that you shouldn't have, and you have been caught with the words of your mouth. Do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go, humble yourself, and beg and plead and importune your neighbor. Do not give sleep. Don't go to sleep. You know, a lot of people in the time of trouble curl up in the bed in the fetal position. The covers pulled up over their head, you see. Wrong time. Wrong thing to do. Do not give sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself as fast as you can get, like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Great wisdom. Don't rest until you get that situation worked out. It's like I told my daughter, oldest daughter recently, well, my mother actually told her, and I just reaffirmed it, you upset a teacher? You need to get to the teacher quickly and get that situation resolved. Because it will go better for you if you do that versus ignoring it. Oh, you know, what does she know? Oh, I don't really care, or I'm not going to pursue that. Wrong attitude, wrong frame of mind, wrong perspective. These proverbs, brethren, give great advice, soundness of mind in telling us what we should do. Chapter 7, verse 1, "My son, my child, keep my words and treasure my commandments within you." Not just, you know, eye service when I see you, but when I'm not around. "Let my commands be inside of you. Make them a part of your life. Keep my commandments and live, and my teachings as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister." I can think of many times when remembering the words of my mother, the advice she had given, the commands she had laid down, saved me from a lot of difficulty, a lot of terrible situations. A lot of things that my peers were doing. Our high school used to be called Marijuana High, because one person, this is why they call it Marijuana High, one person was arrested outside the school who was not even a student of the school with one joint. So they labeled the whole, the headlines of the paper was Marijuana High, you know, because of that one situation back in the early 60s. But I've been around musicians a large part of my life. I've been around in the music world, or say the arty world, especially in the music scene that I was involved in. There were homosexuals everywhere. My first music teacher was a homosexual. But because of the instruction and the care and the carefulness that my mother provided for me, I was able to avoid the pitfalls that were there and be able to say no with some foundation. Just simply saying no with no foundation means nothing, you know, whether it's about drugs or anything else. But all of that was very beneficial to me in helping me get over the rough spots. Last time we had read in Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter, verses 1 through 7, where parents are told in no uncertain terms to instruct or to discipline their children. And Proverbs, as we have discovered, is replete with all kinds of instruction. Back in the 2nd chapter of Proverbs, we have the entire chapter here, which I will not read for sake of time. But it says, "My child, my son, my daughter, if you will receive my sayings and treasure my commandments within you, make your ear attentive to wisdom. Incline your heart to understanding. For if you cry for discernment, if you long for it, lift your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver and search for her as hidden treasure, then you will discern the fear of the Lord," because that is the beginning of wisdom and instruction and understanding. That is, after all, the end result that you desire. You want your child to be able to say, like Solomon did in conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes, you know, that in all the duty of man, all that we are about, ultimately, is to fear God, to respect Him and honor Him and be in awe of Him and keep His commandments. That's it. That's what you want. You're not concerned about, well, if you get all A's, you see, then I'll be pleased. A whole lot of brilliant students who are lousy people, who have no character, who step on people, you know, you understand that. So you want more than just good grades and a lot of money in the bank, you know, and good looks. You want more than that. Well, we could read on through the 2nd chapter about a number of things, but I want to emphasize, at least in two movies that came to mind in thinking about examples that have been on the silver screen concerning single parents, for instance, and that is in much more proclivity today than in times past. In the movie Imitation of Life, there was a situation where there were two single parents, one black and one white. And I think Lana Turner was in one version of this. He played the woman who discovered this pancake batter, I think it was. And so, I mean, it was just so great that she became quite wealthy. And the lady who helped her develop it and work with it was the black lady, and both of them had daughters, you see. The sad situation was that both parents made the same mistake. They loved their daughters tremendously. The wealthy white woman gave her daughter everything, including a car and all everything that she wanted. The black woman, the idea of the movie, of course, Imitation of Life, was that the black woman's daughter was very fair-skinned, and the Imitation of Life was the fact that she passed as white. And that's the whole gist of it. But the point is that in loving that daughter who passed as white, her mother loved her tremendously, but her daughter, living in the peer pressure of that environment, and those of you who've seen the movie understand, the pressure was that she wanted to be as equal as the white daughter and have everything that she had, and her mother couldn't somehow get through her to understand that it's just the reality of it is that you can't have that. That's the reality of it, is that that's her mother and her daughter, and we are not in that situation. But she wanted it so much that she determined that she would pass, even to ignoring and refusing to acknowledge her mother. She went that far. And at the end, when her mother was dead, and she could no longer communicate to her as she went to the funeral to express her sorrow and her shame of having done that, it was too late. It was far too late at that point. The other movie, Mildred Pierce, Joan Crawford, Anne Blythe. If you recall, Joan Crawford was down on her luck, and she came up with some business scheme that netted her great bucks, and she did the same thing with her daughter. The fine car, the good life, no responsibility. Do your thing, daughter, because I love you so much. There were so many years when we didn't have anything, and now we've got all of this, and you just should have it. Because I didn't have it, I want you to have it. With no responsibility, and it ultimately winds up where Mildred Pierce kills her lover, who was somehow associated, involved with her daughter. And it was a sad, sad case of example of how parents, be they single or in tandem with one another, make serious mistakes in judgment. The kinds of mistakes pointed out in an article, or it's an article here in the U.S. Today, USA Today, Thursday, where Monsignor William O'Brien works with an outfit in New York called the Daytop Village, which is an agency, a rehabilitation agency for young people that repairs families. He says that the family is under siege. And it is. He states, and the young people are the casualties. The family unit suffers even in the best communities, according to O'Brien. And he says the television set creates walls. There is almost no communication at home. All through the sermon, we have talked about, well, where do you start? Where do you begin? And what's the starting point? And he says communication. Well, we throw that up everywhere. Husband and wife problems, you got to communicate more. Parent-child problem, you got to communicate more. Student-teacher, you got to communicate more. Government, you got to communicate. You know, we use that all over the place. But when will we start to talk and to share and communicate? He says this, the absence of communication, is the root of the problem. O'Brien believes, if it is not tackled, he warns, quote, the country's finished. Generation after generation is sinking because we don't understand what's happening. O'Brien cites the rigorous training and preparation that doctors and other caregivers must undergo, but he points out that the very fulcrum of society, the building block of society, is a profession called parenting, and there is absolutely no preparation for it. Parents have to be part doctor, clergyman, teacher, even taxi driver. In order to keep the wounded family, or to help the wounded family, we have to take a hard look at the process of parenting, and we do. And another same page of this is an interview by given to Eugene Sawyer, the current mayor of the city of Chicago. He is the chairman of the National Task Force on the Next Generation. And he said, in answer to the question, well, what is the problem? What's the basic problem today? He says, I think one basic problem concerns the unified family. The issue has to be addressed, and some support has to be given to that single family head, because they're the ones under the great, great pressure. But the tandem family is under pressure as well. But he recognizes that that family unit is crucial in developing what needs to be done. Monsignor William O'Brien gives this example. He says that he has sympathy for parents. The seductive trap is one's love for one's children. Things like, parents will say this, if you get all A's, I'll get you a car. you know. Oh, a lot of parents bribe their children with that sort of thing. I know a lady who has a daughter who's an all-A student at the University of Michigan. And she's been an all-A student for a lot of years. But a president of a bank happened to be in proximity of this girl, and he said to her, if you get all A's this term, I'll give you $1,000. And she knows that, and she's going to get all A's for the $1,000. But this is also a daughter who cannot be resisted in going to Acapulco. She was in Pasadena for the Rose Bowl, goes everywhere. Mother really can't afford it, but mother goes out and works two jobs to keep providing this daughter with all of this accoutrements. And at some point in time, it's going to bite. It's going to hurt. Because, as this man goes on to say, continuing with this quote about buying a child a car, it actually deprives that child of the right to earn his or her way in life, to go out and break his rear end to save money and earn a car. Probably would appreciate it more. You think you do that out of love, but you're not. We must break the cycle. We're in trouble. Those are quotes dealing with children and child rearing. The time is fleeting at this point, and we're going to have to continue next time developing this message concerning child rearing. But the importance of the family unit has not been lost on the public, as I have quoted to you these two individuals. The many books and discussions underscore that fact. And the quotes, again, as I've mentioned, cite that. Now, as I said, the objective, as we learned in the Proverbs, was to allow a child to get to the point of saying, God's way is best, and my parents have taught me what God's way is. And essentially what you are developing in a child is character. You either develop character in them, along with the character that you are developing in yourselves, or you become a character. And we all know about them. We see them. We go to the mall, and we see the children controlling the situation, don't we? We see it all over. We go to restaurants. We're in all kinds of environments where children, at such a little age, and there are psychologists and those dealing with child psychology justify, so, well, it's just a stage, and they will grow out of it. But we also see the adults, as I mentioned last time, the grown children, who continue to do and display the same attitudes and difficulties that children display. Character doesn't come just from heredity or osmosis or association or divine fiat. It's built, and much effort must be expended in developing it. The next time, we will explore the practical side of preschool and in between years and look at some practical situations that are concerned in child rearing. Children are a gift from God. They are our responsibility. If we want them to have good lives now and ultimately go over into the family of God as we desire to do, we must put forth the kind of effort in learning and teaching and training that will bring us the great fruition, the fruit that we want and desire for our children.